change. Interested? Visit your local Citroen retailer or search Citroen Vans. Offer valid 4th to 18th November 24. Saving against OTR price. Business users only. Selected stock. Participating retailers only. T's and C's and eligibility criteria apply.
Citroën. The hairdresser's brushing up on the best business advice with my friend Deborah Meaden.
Well, Einstein, staying on top of your numbers is crucial.
Indeed, and a smart meter can help you track your energy use and costs over time, so you can trim and adjust where needed.
Meaning more control of your business budgeting.
Now that's sharp.
Search Get a Smart Meter for Business today. Eligibility may vary. Consumer action required.
Tim's listening party was a lockdown sensation.
Unfortunately, it was on Twitter, which you can't listen to.
But Absolute Radio has the solution.
Tim Burgess explores seminal albums alongside the artists who brought them to life.
Absolute Radio presents Tim's Listening Party with Tim Burgess.
Hi, I'm Tim Burgess, and welcome to another episode of Tim's Listening Party on Absolute Radio. If it's your first time listening, this is a show where I sit down with an artist, going through a classic album and hearing the stories behind it. We've had loads of interesting conversations so far with guests from Sparks and Texas to The Kinks and U2. To catch up on any of these episodes, just search for Tim's Listening Party wherever you get your podcasts to discover a whole archive of past listening parties. Just like Tim's Twitter listening party, a huge part of this is your involvement. So please get involved on social media throughout the show using the hashtag Tim's Listening Party and check out at Tim_Burgess and at Absolute Radio on X for more listening party content. This episode I'm joined by Elvis Costello to talk about his 1986 album King of America, which has been re-released as King of America and Other Realms, a new 6-disc box set including the remaster of this classic album, a previously unreleased live concert, demos, outtakes, live recordings, so much there to discover. Elvis Costello has rightly been lauded as one of the greatest songwriters of his generation. His music embraces jazz, country, classical, rhythm and blues, rock and roll, Tin Pan Alley, with Dylan-esque lyricism which is underpinned by punk ethics and traditions. His genre-spanning career has seen him cross paths with everyone from Alan Toussaint to The Roots, Paul McCartney to Burt Bacharach, and his genius has been rewarded with a BAFTA, multiple Grammys, and Ivor Novello Awards.
Allison, I know this world is killing you. Oh, Allison, all of us are here to stay. All of us are on their way. And I would rather be anywhere else but today. Pump it up when you don't really need it. Pump it up until you can feel it.
Down in the. So I think we're on.
We're on,
which is very exciting, and I'm very excited to talk to you. I really wanted to kind of start by saying that, you know, I wanted to thank you for appearances on Top of the Pops when I was a kid.
Oh my God.
And I wanted to thank you for Oliver's Army and, you know, watching The Detectives, Accidents Will Happen, Don't Want to Go to Chelsea. I also wanted to thank you for Shipbuilding. I wanted to thank you for The Other Side of Summer. That's probably one of my favorite records of yours.
I like that record.
It's so good. And and thanks for doing this.
Thank you. It's funny, when I was in the country right on my birthday, which was a big one this year, I was telling the audience at the shows afterwards, I said I was listening, I watch radio, BBC4, a lot, you know, because it's late at right. night and they're showing old quiz shows from the 70s that I remember when I was a teenager, and I was like, they come on, the continuity announcer comes on and goes, and now, in a tribute to one of Britain's least remembered songwriters, here is a Top of the Pops, and they showed the very first one we were ever on, the very first Top of the Pops we were on, and we'd flown down from Glasgow.
Right.
We'd actually had to charter a plane. You know,
which
was
a big deal. Were you on tour? Is he on tour? Is that?
Well, it wasn't so much that we were on tour. First yeah. time up in Scotland, banned out of playing in Glasgow because everything on the Stiff label was regarded as probably it was going to be that dastardly punk rock. And the Damned had been up there with the Pistols, and they weren't having that kind of music anymore, the City Fathers. It was so strange. It was like you read about in the 50s, you know, we had to play in a hotel in Paisley, get up the next morning and honestly go to the little airfield, and all the money that the record company Stiff could afford was for this little prop plane. You know, it wasn't anything, it wasn't a private jet by any means. It's like Biggles came out of a hut to fly us down to. It was terrifying. And then we were thrust into the world of show business, and the rest is misery. You know, it's funny to see it though, because you know, I was so proud of my Musicians Union card that I wore it in my top pocket.
Oh yeah,
they still had an orchestra then on the Top of the Pops, and I wanted to prove to the old guys, some of whom were friends of my dad's, that, you know, I was a real musician. I wasn't some sort of interloper. Yeah.
And how old were you on your first appearance?
Probably, it was, I might just have been 23, I think, 22 or 23. First time. 21 when I wrote the record, between 21 and 22 when I wrote the record and recorded it, because it wasn't all recorded at once.
Yeah.
And then, you know, then you get into it a little bit and you sort of get into the routine, as I'm sure you're very familiar with, where you are, you know, it's time to make a record, and you have to hope that you've got the inspiration when it's time, when you've got a contract. It's sort of great in one respect, as there's some continuity and security to it.
Yeah.
A certainty of a job, but after a while, one, you can either become entitled to it, or you can... It may, you know, the date in the calendar may not be where you're feeling that you're sharpest about what you want to do next, you know. So I think that's why records go up and down in quality. It's not necessarily that people have lost their minds. It's just, you know, sometimes they've lost their minds.
You were always on the telly.
It felt like for a while as if it was.
It's so great.
Thank goodness we got away from that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, well, thank goodness I was there to see that.
Yeah. Yeah, well, somebody, I mean, that's the thing, when people said, oh, you changed the number on, when the first time we were on American television, we switched the number out live on the air. I said, I was only doing what I saw Jimi Hendrix do when I was a teenager. And I wasn't even a teenager, I was probably not, don't know what year that was, it was when Hendrix was on the Lulu show and he switched, it was 1968, so yeah, I was a teenager, yeah. That's all of it, isn't it? I think it's what you, the cues you get, the special thing that you're on. You know, I mean, I remember all sorts of funny things of being on the television early on. I remember being, you know, you're being on with people like Hank Marvin was on one time, and I was in a chair next to him, and he wears the same kind of glasses as I do.
Yes.
And the makeup, you know, ladies were trying to make us both look presentable. I have to say, I had a lot less work to do on Hank than on me. But, you know, it bizarre kind of things would happen like that. Or you'd be on... We did one show in Birmingham where there was actually a revolving stage, and we played our number and revolved out of sight, and the Buzzcocks came in playing their number.
Was that the show Revolver?
Revolver.
Peter Cook
as the host, which was a disastrous idea of Mickey Most. And the audience really hated Peter Cook, and he didn't want to be there, and it was like, seemed like a good idea in theory, but it was a complete...
It's kind of punk.
It was... So, yeah, because he just gave back the insults to them because he was quick, you know. But, but I spoke to him briefly, and I think he didn't really know me from on the ground, but I think he might have had a couple of drinks, you know, just to sort of like take the edge off the indignity. Yeah.
Let's kick off this listening party with the first track from King of America, It's Brilliant Mistake.
You thought he was the king of America. Vintage wine. Now I try hard not to become hysterical, but I'm not sure if I'm laughing or crying. I wish that I could push a button and talk in the past and not the present tense. And what's this hurting feeling? Disappear like it was common sense. It was a fine idea at the time. Now it's a breeze.
she was working for the ABC News. It was as much of the alphabet as she knew how to use. Her perfume was unspeakable. It lingered in the air like her artificial laughter and the mentors of affairs. Oh, I say, you know. Was the king of America, but it was just the boulevard of broken dreams, tripped through with mirrors and with chemicals, the words of love and whispers and the acts of wooden screams. I wish that I could push a button and talk in the past and not the present tense.
That was Brilliant Mistake by Elvis Costello, the first song from his 1986 album, King of America. It's Tim Burgess there, up in the listening party with Elvis Costello on Absolute Radio, going through that very album. So, we're going to go through it track by track, if that's okay with you, and, you know, we can
sure.
get some interesting quips and bursts of insight.
Ha!
So it opens with Brilliant Mistake, and also opens with the lyric that gives the album its name.
Mm-hmm.
He thought he was the king of America, where they pour Coca-Cola just like vintage wine. Then it goes on later to say that he was the king of America, but it was the boulevard of broken dreams. Is it a song about disillusionment, how the mighty fall, or...?
I think it was trying to do a lot of things at once, actually.
Okay.
I felt like it carried... I knew that it was kind of the theme song of the record before
yeah, okay.
I recorded it. You know, I did know that much.
Well...
Curiously enough, as we put this box together, separately to the version that's heard on King of America, the original album,
mm-hmm.
there's a second CD inside that box which contains the demos that I made, some of which I hadn't heard for 40 years.
Oh, my God.
Because I put them away in a cupboard and we'd yeah. just forgotten about them. And I had a, when we were putting this together, I said... I don't think we've got all the demos here. We've got only the ones recorded in Hollywood. What happened to the ones that I did in London? And Billy went, what ones you did in London? I said, I did a session. I remember I did it. I couldn't even remember the name of the studio. I have
yeah.
no notebooks
wow.
of these drafts of these songs. And when we got the tape, and, you know, thankfully it was in good enough condition to... wasn't a lot to mix. It's just a guitar and a voice. Brilliant Mistake. Gets to the second verse and it becomes a completely different song.
Oh.
I mean, it's about something different. There's no stuff about the ABC News, that's not in it.
Right.
And I wouldn't say it's a better lyric, but it might be a little bit more true to life, so to speak. It's a much more of an account of what I think might have been going on around that time.
Okay.
And as you sometimes come to recognise, if you write enough songs... writing things out in a literal way isn't always the most communicative thing. It can be satisfying to do it, but it can also be indulgent.
Yeah.
So at some point I decided to change the song to the one you hear on the,
yeah.
And it therefore it moves around from topic to topic. It moves from the personal to the more universal.
Yeah.
Whereas the other song stayed completely personal all the way. Now, people would have to hear that demo, said, well, I think you should have recorded that. Well, I didn't, because that isn't what I wanted to do. But that's part of the process of writing, and it's unusual to find the sketches for something and find them to be so different to the finished thing.
Yeah.
It's, for me, very, very unusual for me not to remember them, because I remember everything. Yeah. You know, I can remember gigs I did 40 years ago, what songs I sang, color of the wallpaper, you know, it's almost a curse. This, for some reason, maybe I shut it away and didn't want to confront what the songs were about. That, like I say, I still hold to the fact that the song that you hear on that record is a brighter, more conflicted song, rather than the demo is a much more desperate sounding thing. It's much more defeated. And I don't think that's the way you'd want to open a record,
no,
is it? You'd want
no,
to
exactly.
open it with
okay, I'd love to
it
hear opens. It in mind, but you know.
Yeah, well you can.
Yeah,
you can.
Well.
You can hear it in a bus it, and it, you know, it's a not as pretty a performance as this is, because you've got all the other decorative elements. You've got Jerry Sheff and Mickey Curry in the rhythm section, and you've got T-Bone Walk, who was actually a bass player but was also a terrific accordionist and he's playing, you know, both guitar, and he overdubbed guitar, and we didn't do a lot of overdubs. You know, most of this record was played live in the studio or, you know, gathered around me. But once in a while, there would just be one other part added, a piano part here or whatever it was, you know. I played mandolin. It's my only credit as a mandolinist, you know. Brutal though that playing is, you know, on little passes, you know.
Wonderful.
But I think you're right. And the tune is a kind of folk melody, which is found in... It's found in hymns.
Yes.
It's found in Aaron Copland's Appalachian Spring. He used
nice.
The same melody. This da da do da da do da da do da, that kind of movement.
Yeah.
It's in pop songs. It's not a melody that I can really lay claim to. It's a folk melody, really. A lot of pop songs have origins of that. And that seemed like the right thing when you're talking about both an ideal and a location.
And
I was
song.
There doing it. Actually, there I was doing it. I didn't imagine the record would be recorded quite as it was. I did originally conceive this album as being one side acoustic and the second side electric.
Right.
And Brilliant Mistake might have actually been the last track on the record.
Well,
with a full electric accompaniment. That's in the total abstract. That's what I heard.
Yeah.
Once I abandoned that first draft, the next thought was it was going to be electric, and therefore the Attractions would have played it.
Yeah.
But they never did, because we cut this version, and that was the end of that. And that's kind of what happened with a lot of the recordings on this, is that the process of recording led me to a different way to express the songs that seemed at that moment to be the right one. And although I've played many of these songs with members of the then Attractions, now the Impostors, the recorded versions were the ones that were on the album.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that's the right one.
Yeah, and it's the moment, isn't it, as well? You know, you're capturing the time.
Yeah, it was the moment where you recognise, oh, that's the way it goes.
Yeah,
you know,
that's it.
That one a little bit more than some of the other songs, which were more obviously lent themselves to the style of players that we had in the studio, I think.
Got you, okay.
One, two, three, four.
Let's hear the second track from King of America. This is Lovable.
Yes, sir. The map is
Listening Party on Absolute Radio. Elvis Costello joins me to talk about his album, King of America. That last track was called Lovable. And I've just, my only note here is You're So Lovable. I mean, it's such a gorgeous song.
Yeah.
And I guess that's kind of a bit, it's a bit more, it's upbeat, isn't it? It's a great second track, you know, and kind of, you got the opening one, A Brilliant Mistake, and then Lovable is up-tempo.
It's kind of like an Everly Brothers Buddy Holly kind of trick with that, you know, that quick little figure on the guitar. And unusual, it was kind of like, I hadn't played sort of swinging rhythms like that since my first record.
Yeah.
Bear in mind, my first record was accompanied by American musicians as well, and the American, you know, they have easy access to that swinging sort of feel, you know, and also maybe because it don't always play too fast. English bands tend to be really like urgent, you know, and all the best ones. And I've said this many times, but I do think there's some truth to it. I said, like, if you think about it, all the great English rock bands, rock and roll bands, very few of them know how to close a phrase off. They just know how to start. And their first idea, like The Who, you know, I can't explain, you know.
Yeah.
Of course, there is a groove to a lot of these records, and people would cite many examples of it. The Beatles had some amazing feels, particularly towards the end of their career. But compare that to Booker T and the MGs.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Or the Funk Brothers, where everything is about how we phrase together and the discipline. Yeah. Or even like Muddy Waters bands, you know, if you listen to what's actually going on, it's why bands copying them sound so terrible and why those records sound so great, is because they're not all playing the same thing. They're not all going dunk, 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 dunk. There's all different angular things going on. It's arranged. It might be harmonically very, very just using three chords or one chord sometimes. But nobody steps on anybody else, and that's the difference, largely speaking, I think, between the English and American approach to the same musical language. Of course, the two countries have like influenced each other in that approach. There's bands in America that copied that gung-ho kind of English approach, you know, English British, I suppose, because you get some Scottish groups as well, you know. But there's something to this. It's not just a mad theory that, you know. What I recognize right away was I'm in the studio basically with Elvis Presley's band. You know, I've got three of Elvis Presley's band. Most of all, I've got James Burton on electric guitar.
Love him.
I'm not going anywhere near an electric guitar while he's in the room. That's definitely not going to happen. I just play rhythm. And I, you know, there was so much space for a song.
Yeah.
You know, Lovable, I think, is Keltner. Is Jim Keltner. I think that was cut a little bit later.
I've actually had the pleasure of playing with Jim Keltner, which is wonderful.
He's an incredible musician.
Oh, yeah.
And James Burton,
I mean, I think of, I know, obviously, he's Elvis' guitarist, but Gram Parsons, I'm a huge Gram Parsons fan.
Truthfully, I have to give credit to T-Bone Burnett. He was the one that wrote down the names of the players next to the songs, and I thought he was kidding. You know, I thought, can you just get James Burton on your record? But is there a sort of some exam you have to pass before you can have that happen? I didn't realize you just called them up and invited them and booked them for the session. To me, they were just names on record sleeves, you know. And Keltner was on so many records, many of which I really loved, that I thought he can't possibly be as open as he turns out to be, as inventive as he turns out to be. He must be more, I don't know, I just had this crazy delusion that he'd be more settled in his way, and he approaches everything as if it's brand new. And so, I mean, when we got in, there was some of my own prejudices I had to get over, and not prejudices, you know, bias that I just felt like, he, and then I go, oh my God, this is incredible. With Ronnie Tutt, you know, who played in that TCB band, as we called them, because it was three members of the Elvis band. That was just such a machine between him and Jerry Sheff that, you know, James was totally free to play the decorative parts. And it's true to say I was the same. I was most thrilled that I had the guy that had played on The Return of the Grievous Angel and was in the hot band with Emmy, you know. And that was my thrill of James coming in. I didn't want to make a big deal, and I wondered whether any of those guys would have any misgiving about working with me because of my stupid stage name, you know. And they, you know, I think they realized right away I wasn't an Elvis impersonator, you know. I mean, it was like, I was truthfully not even that much of an Elvis Presley fan. That's the weird thing. I mean, I love the Sun Records and I love the Memphis Records, you know, but nothing else really. Not compared with Little Richard, you know, or Jerry Lee. So of that era, I learned a lot of that music after the fact. And the fact that the Beatles championed Little Richard made Little Richard the rock and roll guy to pay attention to. I knew the Beatles spoke about Elvis, but I didn't hear the evidence of them sounding like him. Whereas Paul McCartney actually sang Long Tall Sally, you know.
Yeah, they did.
Given any chance, he would sing Lucille, you know. When I worked with him much later, you know, when I was grown up and I got to write with Paul, I went to a rehearsal one night when he was hiring musicians for his touring band and ended up playing piano. Because there was no pianist. He'd already picked the pianist, so there was no pianist. So I ended up playing best I could, a little bit rhythm piano. And it was only when he said, okay, we're going to play Lucille. I go, well, no, I'm sitting this one out. I can't play that part, you know. So that was what he wanted to play. It was like he wanted to test the musician's ability to play songs that he'd loved since he had been a teenager. Didn't matter whether I assumed that they were at the audition, they could play the songs he'd written. But he wanted to know whether they could feel the other songs, all right? Then that's kind of what the experience had. I knew I had all this shared language with these musicians. I knew that Jim Keltner was the drummer on Boomer's Story. Just that one song.
Yeah.
If he was just the drummer on Boomer's Story, that would be enough for me, you know?
Right.
Because that, you know, it's the same as, like, you know, Graham going, pick it for me, James. And then he plays that little, tells a story. Or James's solo on Till I Got in Control Again, you know, on Elite Hotel, you know. I mean, these were things that I thought, if I can get anything that complements the melody I've written that's anywhere. And he does it several times on the record. You know, he plays a solo short and concise and beautifully constructed straight out of thin air. And also it's pretty exciting when he, on the big light, when he did, then he's doing the CC Rider kind of,
very,
you know,
exciting.
Elvis in Vegas kind of guitar playing, you know, and you kind of go, oh my God, you know, and so, get my karate kit out, you know.
Moving on to track 3 on the album, it's Our Little Angel.
This is the place where I made my best mistakes. This is the place even angels don't understand. I seen the disappointment in her face, the collection of engagement rings on her right hand. She sits alone apart from the crowd in a white dress. She wears like a question mark. Friends speak of her fondly, enemies just think out loud. You think you're mad enough to please her, and you're fool enough to start. But you're not gonna do a thing to our little angel. There's nothing you're thinking tonight that tomorrow. Now the cabaret is frozen and the laughter comes in cans. And the Lonely Hearts Club clientele don't know what to do with their hands. You think that you'd be sweet to her, but everybody knows that you're the marshmallow valentine that got stuck on her clothes. And you're not gonna do a thing to our little angel. There's nothing you're thinking tonight that tomorrow won't change.
mix your drinks and words. You make bad jokes, you make bad time. The flaws are there to walk over, the walls are there to climb. You swear you'll never go back again once you're inside. Gonna do a thing, but you are little angel. There's nothing you think of tonight that tomorrow won't change. You come in a sweetheart and you go out a stranger. When you try to love her, but you're so contrary, like a chainsaw. Gonna do a thing to a little angel.
Elvis Costello with Our Little Angel. I'm Tim Burgess and I'm delighted to be chatting to Elvis Costello for a listening party.
I wanted to talk about my favourite on the album. It's, well, there's a couple of favourites, but one of my, you know, one of my favourites, Our Little Angel.
Yeah.
Pulls at the heartstrings, or certainly pulls at my heartstring.
Yeah.
Mentions mistakes again.
Yeah.
I know, it's in the lyric, or misfortune.
I think it is. I mean, it's a portrait, it's a snapshot of a, you know, sort of girl who is the queen of a particular scene,
yeah.
You know. And I guess I probably had... I usually don't write, like, exactly, like, true to life. I try to think of things that have happened or things I've observed and put them in a song so other people can see themselves. If they're too many inside references to something that really happened,
yeah.
Nobody knows what the hell are you talking about. It's some conversation you had, you know, 5 years ago or 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Or, and if the song's going to endure, it's got to be in language that people can understand.
I mean, I'm going to say that I do the same thing.
Oh, we all do it.
Yeah,
it's the degree to which you settle on. Some people settle for the literal thing, and I'm not saying there's anything wrong with it. But for me, it just being exactly what happened doesn't make it a better song.
Agreed.
It only makes it a better song if you're somehow magically able to make that communicate to everybody. And a lot of the really great so-called confessional records have an element of craft within the writing, which you ignore at your peril if you're trying to write like those people.
The
numerous people that have tried to go to Where Blue Lives,
yeah,
you know, by Joni, or where Blood on the Tracks, which is a very good example of this thing where
it can't be copied, can it?
Some of the time seems to be completely revealing, then there's an obvious line of invention within the lyric.
You know,
I met a man from Italy. I mean, these things could be transpositions of real events, but they disguise the nakedness of pain or anger in songs, not to evade it, but to make it so that it's... I honestly believe there's an ingenuity to that writing.
Yeah.
And I've tried to learn little by little not to just indulge the instinct to literally write out the account, but to think about how it feels to experience something. You can't slow life down to the pace of heartbreak. You can't slow the listener's life down to the pace of, you know... The great country songs, they distill experiences.
Yeah.
You know, I've been living a new life, you know, or whatever the opening line is. By the door, you know, you'll see the nursery. She left me without mercy. That's The Grand Tour by George Strauss. I mean, two lines and it completely distills the thing of somebody being abandoned, you know, somebody leaving a family home.
Yeah.
I don't suppose that real true to life in real time account of that scanned. You know, it probably involved throwing things and screaming and crying and recrimination and stuff that doesn't fit in a verse. And it's possible to represent those things in music, of course it is, but it doesn't necessarily work like that when you're trying to write this type of music to it. This was the distilled version of those experiences, like Our Little Angel. And I'm glad you like that.
Oh,
that
it's amazing.
One has a lovely James. That has a beautiful James interlude in it.
This perfectly scans. Now the cabaret are frozen and the laughter comes in cans. And the Lonely Hearts Club clientele don't know what to do with their hands. I mean, it's gorgeous.
Yeah. Well, I used to play a Lonely Hearts Club in Liverpool with my partner. We used to play one. And I know it sounds like a joke. We played a Lonely Hearts Club in Liverpool, but it really was. It was held in an old former RAF serviceman's club. And they would hire it for this mixer club. It was basically like it was a forerunner of Tinder, you know.
Yeah.
It was like where people would go to meet. And people were still quite inhibited, and one side of the room would be young women and the other side men, but they wouldn't speak at first. They'd be too shy.
They'd come
and
on.
Then we'd play to almost complete indifference while they were all furtively looking at each other. And then, of course, once they had a couple of drinks and they started talking, then they ignored us anyway. So we never had any respect. But that's like 1972.
Wow. Yeah. Up next is Don't Let Me Be Misunderstood on Absolute Radio.
Baby, can you understand me now? Sometimes I feel a little mad. Don't you know that no one alive can always be an angel? When things go wrong, I seem to be mad.
From Elvis Costello's King of America, Don't Let Me Be Misunderstood, playing on Absolute Radio. Don't Let Me Be Misunderstood, which was the single. Is it your favourite Nina Simone song?
To be really honest, I learnt it from the Animals because of my age. I heard it first by the Animals.
Right.
I love Nina Simone's version. I love her records, but I can't pretend that I learnt it firsthand from her. Obviously, I heard Eric Burdon first.
Yeah, that's a good version.
I did toy with the idea of completely remixing it
right.
in this record
okay.
at one point.
I didn't know whether anybody would be interested to hear a parallel remix. Obviously, you wouldn't replace the original mix. And one of the reasons I wanted to do it was to take this track off the record, because I don't think it belongs on the record. It was added at the insistence of the record company because they hated the songs than the rest of the record. They didn't understand why I was writing these, to them, miserable country songs, and didn't think that the, you know, people who had been excited about Every Day I Write the Book, and, you know, which was a bright pop sort of sound and thing, would play this, and they were probably right, because they didn't play it, but this song on its own didn't change that. It was just an attempt to make something, and I thought, well, that's a big compliment, isn't it? You've written Indoor Fireworks, American Without Tears, Brilliant Mistake, Poison Rose,
Little Angel, phenomenal.
But you've written those songs, and you hand them in to the record company, and they say, well, what we really need is a good song. And can it be something people already know? And that's basically where we, we parted the ways, because I wasn't going back. I was, even then I knew I wasn't going there anymore.
Yeah.
And the few opportunities I've had to smuggle an idea that mattered to me onto the radio in the guise of pop music, I'd already done it, obviously. Oliver's Army is a very good example of a bright pop tune that's singing about something serious. Other Side of Summer's another example. Veronica's another example. So it's not like I abandoned. I'm not a snob about pop music, but it's not. It wasn't going to be the whole of the reason why this record existed. So I think we made a pretty interesting record out of Don't Let Me Be Misunderstood.
Yeah, no, it sounds fantastic.
Notwithstanding me having completely lost my voice when we did it, and so the voice. I thought the irony of it was this was recorded at the insistence of Columbia Records, and then when they got the record, nobody could recognize me on the record because it didn't sound like me.
Right.
I was so hoarse when I sang it. I don't know, it could have been Harvey Fierstein, isn't he? That guy that's. It could have been him singing it, you know?
The next song is Glitter Gulch.
We lived in a metamix, painted in a shocking pink spangled dress. The teeth of perfect better matches, please. Rubbing their hands together, she possessed the medicine that a chicken fed. Yeah.
This is Tim's Listening Party on Absolute Radio.
We play these parlor games. We play it make-believe. When we get to the part where I say that I'm gonna leave, everybody loves a happy ending, but we don't even try. We go straight past pretending to the part where everybody loves to cry. Indoor fireworks can still burn your fingers. Indoor fireworks, we swore we're safe as houses. They're not so spectacular. They don't burn up in the sky, but they can dazzle on a light. I'll bring a tear when the smoke gets in your eye. You were the spice of life, the gin in my vermouth. And though the sparks would fly, thought our love was fireproof. Sometimes we'd fight in public, darling, with very little cause. But different kinds of sparks would fly when we got on our own behind closed doors. Indoor fireworks can still burn your fingers. Indoor fireworks, we saw were safe as houses. They're not so spectacular. They don't burn up in the sky, but they can dazzle all the light. I'll bring a tear when the smoke gets in your eye. It's time to tell the truth. These things have to be faced. My fuse is burning out, and all that bound has gone to waste. Don't think for a moment, dear, that we'll ever be through. I'll build a bonfire of my dreams and burn a broken effigy of me and you. Indoor fireworks can still burn your fingers. Indoor fireworks, we swore were safe as houses. They're not so spectacular. They don't burn up in the sky, they can dazzle hard and light. I'll bring a tear when the smoke gets in your eye. When the smoke gets in your eye. When the smoke gets in your eye.
Glitter Gulch, followed by Indoor Fireworks.
Yeah, well,
there's no real question. It's just I'm just making an observation.
No, it's just a statement. It's just really. A statement. You're just making a statement.
I really like Glitter Gulch, but I mean, you know, I'm also excited to get to Indoor Fireworks.
Come on,
as well.
No, but I mean, let's be straightforward here. That's the other one that I probably would have. There's three tracks I might have taken off a remixed version of this record, and obviously this is just theorizing.
Yeah,
anybody
of course.
This. Because you just make a playlist of your favourite songs on this record. Glitter Gulch was something I came up with because I wanted to hear more James Burton, really.
Fine.
I just wanted to hear him play.
Yeah.
I wrote it in 5 minutes. It's like a nothing song. I mean, you've got to say that I'd go home from
the studio and turn on the television. I probably had a few cocktails and, you know, like game shows and stuff like that. The lurid nature of it. You're in Hollywood. They're surrounded by the supposed glamour and the actual sleaze of Hollywood, you know, and that's not, you're not, don't have to go looking for it. It's in all of the weird juxtaposition. The song is not hard to write.
No.
It was like, you know, I'm not dismissing it. It's just a little rockabilly tune, but it was just like, once we'd done The Big Light, I just wanted him to do it again, you know, kind of get one that's a bit faster again and play even wilder, you know.
It reminded me of a Gower Gulch in Hollywood. I used to live in Hollywood.
Well, we were recording right next to it. I don't doubt that Gower Gulch was... I thought, I can't sing Gower Gulch. I thought, no, I have to sing Glitter Gulch. I'm sure that's where I got the title from. Almost certainly where it is.
Wow. God, I mean, I was just throwing that out there then. I know.
I probably wrote it on the way back from the off license. You know, it's one of those. I mean, sometimes those Possession on Get Happy is written on the way back to the studio. And that's a good track.
Yeah, yeah.
Indoor Fireworks is where I think we had settled into the confidence.
Yeah.
To now, it wasn't about, okay, we've got this A-Team, which is the TCB band.
Yeah.
And then we've got the other squad, which is this one over here, which are equally great.
So is it?
And now we've got, like, Jerry Sheff and Jim Keltner as a rhythm section,
yeah,
which is, you know, it's unlovable. Yeah. And I think it's on this record. James Burton playing, you know, on Indoor Fireworks is beautiful. And I think Mitchell Froome was in there as well, who had joined on organ.
Yeah.
We were starting to kind of like, I was starting to kind of be more, less frenetic now and really dig in. And I knew this was a good song. I had to get it right, you know. I knew this was the one, really. It's turned out to be, I mean, the only song from King of America that's ever been covered is Roseanne Cash's version of Our Little Angel.
I
don't know why, you know, country singers have not, like, embraced Indoor Fireworks. I suspect it's because it refers to a martini in the second verse. And martinis are just not the thing, are they, in country music? You know, can't see... That's going to be very relatable, isn't it, if you mention a martini. That sounds like a damn Yankee drink to me.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, no. Anyway, one way or another, I mean,
I love it. Everybody loves the happy ending, but we don't even try.
Well, there's some allusions to Charlie Rich in there as well.
Okay.
You know, Behind Closed Doors is sort of half quoted, and that's a thing that happens a few times in the songs. They locate the drama of the song with a reference to a song that you either knew or loved or happened to be playing, you know.
Yeah.
Happens again in two other songs on this record, and it's a device that I had used from way back, you know, and other people do as well, you know.
The next song is Little Palaces.
In Chocolate Town, all the trains are painted brown, and the silver paper of the wrapper. There's a dapper little man, and he wears a wax mustache that he twists with nicotine fingers as he drops his cigarette ash. And someone comes and sweeps it up, and then he doffs his cap. And there's a rat in someone's bedroom, and there's shit in someone's trap. And they'll soon be pulling down the little palaces. And the doors swing back and forward, from the past into the present. And the bedside crucifixion turns from wood to phosphorescent. And the moving problem families from the south up to the north. Mother's crying over some soft soap opera divorce. And you say you didn't do it, but you know you did, of course. And they'll soon be pulling down the little palaces. Like shouting in a matchbox filled with plasterboard and hope. Like a picture of Prince William in the arms of John the Pope. There's a world of good intentions and pity in their eyes. The sedated homes of England, and there's the vandalized. So you're not
mess about a bit because they've got your name. And you knock your kids about a bit until they feel the same. And they feel like knocking down the little palaces. You're the twinkle in your daddy's eye, a name you spray and scribble. You made the girls all turn their heads, and in turn they made you miserable. To be the heir apparent to the kingdom of the invisible. Where you knock your kids about a bit because they've got your name. And you knock your kids about a bit until they feel the same. And they feel like knocking down the little palaces.
Elvis Costello's Little Palaces from the King of America album. Tim Burgess chatting to Elvis Costello on Absolute Radio. There's a song, Little Palaces, that I don't know why. I don't really want to reference other people's work, but Watertown by Frank Sinatra. I got a similar sort of feeling.
Wow, that's a very asset. Now I would have never guessed that would be the reference point. Very, I'm impressed as all get out there.
I mean, it's just like one of the greatest.
I would take that. I mean, Watertown. It's almost a great record.
Yeah.
I mean, the idea.
Yeah.
I was gonna write a column for a publisher, and I was gonna do a series of reviews of imaginary records.
Yeah.
And my first one was Frank Sinatra Takes a Subway to the Country, which is Frank Sinatra sings David Ackles, which is actually the record he should have made.
Wow.
When he made Watertown. I mean, the quality of songs that David Ackles' catalogue would have given Frank Sinatra would have been a masterpiece if anybody had had the intelligence to put those songs in front of him and persuade him the way Watertown was created, because he was very good at identifying with things in songs. He did it through his entire career. It wasn't all one-liners and, you know, he could really paint the picture.
Yeah.
And he could do it right up to the end of his life as well.
Right, wow.
I mean, I saw him, well, not the very end, but I saw him in 84 when he was not in terrific voice, but his storytelling, not talking story, but the sung storytelling was still beyond nobody. Nobody could go near him. You know, so, yeah, I mean, I think Watertown is, I'll accept that, because it's a portrait of a town.
Little
Palaces is a little bit of my grandfather's rage in that, I think. Sort of a difficult man. My mother's father, that is, he was...
Yeah?
My mother's father.
Mother's
father was a guy who carried a few things around. I didn't know him so very well, but it's like assembled from, you know, where are you from? Are you from the city?
Born in Salford.
You're born in Salford, so you know very much what I'm talking about then.
Yeah,
you know,
of course.
My mother's family home, my grandfather's home is in Liverpool 8, so that's, you know, that's as inlivable as you can get, you know. And so that was that's where they started, and that's where I think, well, that's where we're from, and don't romanticize it, but equally don't dismiss it. So this is a bit of both, this song, I think.
The moments of anger in your voice in this song. Closing side one of the album is I'll Wear It Proudly.
I always thought this was kind of like the R&B song on the record in a way, you know, like it's as much to do with I wanted to really hear Percy Sledge sing it.
Oh, wow.
But I couldn't sing like him, so I had to sing it like me. And it's funny, on the live record that we put in the box, which is from the Albert Hall in 87, the next song in the set is It Tears Me Up. So I must have had that in my mind. Yeah. Like, that if you think about it, it's a little bit more of a, got a little bit more of a pocket than the country songs from this. It's Keltner. And then Mitchell Froome, I gave him this organ part for the end.
Yeah.
Which he then kind of took and put in Crowded House